But there's two guys. There's two different versions of this Mr. Jones. The current version is someone who drinks 5 pints a day. They don't exercise. They entertain themselves more than they educate themselves. They consume more than they produce. They sleep in late. They've got a low-paying job. They don't upskill themselves. The other person, Mr. Smith, I mean, I like Mr. Smith and Mr. Jones, just easy. Mr. Smith has the same goals, but he goes to the gym every day. He dates girls. He started his business because he psychologically got into the right place where he didn't have imposter syndrome, wasn't scared of failure, etc. He reads every day, even if it's something online or an audiobook. He networks. He understands that personal development is the most important thing. He self-reflects. He writes in journals. He goes through his own thought process. He is someone who takes care of his finances. He has a side hustle as well. He travels. At the end of 5 years, those people are going to be so far apart that it's going to be almost impossible for Mr. Jones to catch up to Mr. Smith, even though they had the same goals.
Hey, Javan. How are you?
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me on. As you said, we had a great conversation off air as well, didn't we, say?
Yeah. What do you think is the main thing that limits self-improvement or just improvement in general?
I think it just comes down to your mindset. Because if you don't want to be the best at something, how can you ever become the best at something?
Mm.
If you think of any sports stars, they had the ambition to become world champion or to become a professional. You will never outperform it, other than in very small cases, and that's negligible. You will never outperform your ambition.
Okay, so part of it is a self-fulfilling prophecy in which if you believe that you can, you actually can.
There is some drawbacks to that, which I'm sure we'll come on to, but generally the first start or the starting point is having the mindset of this is what I want to become, and I'm willing to put in the necessary work in order to become that person. Not everyone who thinks about something is going to become that, because at the end of the day, I could say, I want to be the world's fastest man. I want to be faster than Usain Bolt. Now, although half of the equation is settled in respect of my desire, my mindset, my dedication, the other half of the puzzle is not yet or is not correct, because I don't have the physical attributes. I don't have the vast muscle fibers. I don't have the size and speed in order to become the fastest person in the world. So I think there's a fine line between being optimistic and someone who doesn't really understand the realistic approach of undertaking something, if that makes sense.
Yeah, the precise percentages of how much determines your outcomes being 50%, I think, vary across people. I'm sure the opposite side of this same equation is the imposter syndrome. If you believe that you really cannot do what you are facing, you end up underperforming. But there's also cases in which people believe that they cannot do something and they end up delivering much more than they were expecting. But I certainly agree with you in that the first layer of filter, or the main one, which doesn't mean that you cannot, which is a necessary and sufficient criteria. It's neither a necessary one. There's some cases in which people not believing that they can end up having the capacity, but in most of the occasions I 100% agree with you.
Yeah, I think as you said there, it's a case of trying to match up probably your ability with what you're passionate about as well, because if you are passionate about something but have no ability, it's not going to be a success. But also if you've got ability in something but you're not passionate about it, not willing to put the work in, there's also going to be no success. And yes, you may have more success than other people, but what I'm referring to is the higher success that you can achieve based on your ability.
Merge your vocation and your advocation.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's a lot of the battle for a lot of people, isn't it? That their most heart attacks happen on the Monday morning because most people are doing a job they hate for a job that's, or for a salary that's less than they expect, for a boss and a company that they don't believe in. And that's what causes anxiety, and that's what causes those heart attacks on Monday mornings. If you loved your job, Monday mornings would be the greatest day ever, wouldn't they?
Mm. Yeah, well, if you like something, it stops being a job, isn't it? Doesn't it?
Exactly. There's a phrase that job is just over broke, which is what most people are.
Yeah. What do you think of the tall poppy syndrome? Have you ever faced that in your life?
Imposter syndrome?
No, the tall poppy syndrome. That in which your community forces you to not outperform them when they see in you a characteristic which is non-ordinary and positive. Let's say you are really good at math and they see that. And they are like, hey, Jevan, you're not the kind of guy who does good in math. Could you just stop doing that? Or maybe no one actually does explicit comment about that, but they may joke about, hey, Jevan, why don't you just do something else or something like that?
So you're good at something, but they want to make it detrimental for you to do that, essentially. Yeah, so I think Gary Vee put it best, if you're familiar with Gary Vaynerchuk. He said, there's two types of people. One who wants to build the biggest house in town to ensure it's the biggest house in town. And the other is those who tear down all the other houses so that theirs remains the biggest. And I think that from what you're referring to, that is the second of those. And look, you could become the best by being the best of a bad bunch. But why be a big fish in a small pond when you can actually move into the bigger pond and see how you fare? Because yes, psychologically, it can be good for you to be the best of a bunch in terms of hierarchical. But in terms of if you want to really achieve what you should achieve or see what your full potential is, you need to move out of the small pond into pastures new, as they say.
Yeah, this idea is enormously analogous to that of the zero-sum game versus positive-sum game and people who support socialism versus capitalism. And it's just the mindset changes a lot. And it's also true that most of the reason why we end up falling for these biases is our evolutionary heritage. We were not supposed to be conceiving of our resources as being positive sum. Most of the time, our ancestors were more concerned about getting a mate, which was, I think, a zero-sum game. The one you get is not going to be accessible for another male in your group. So the zero-sum game is a hell of a drug, dude. It's just so intuitive and so wrong.
Yeah, I think it comes down to, as you said, coming back from our history, where, you know, are we going to be hunted down by animals? Do we have enough resources? You know, am I in the healthiest position possible? And what issues do I need to avert from in order to ensure survival? You know, the average age of death is 20. Okay, how can I ensure that I am more cautious in my approach? But I think that scarcity-based mindset has got less of a real application nowadays. Because we have a floor, really, of where we're allowed to or never allowed to go below. So society has made it that we need or have roofs over our head generally. We're always going to get food, whether even if we're in prison, essentially. So it's a case of having an abundance mindset now rather than a scarcity mindset, which a lot of the time, obviously, when you're speaking to people and coaching them, it's a case of trying to get rid of those historic mindsets or mind frames and instill new ones that are going to benefit them in the current society that we're in today, if that makes sense.
Yeah, there's certainly, how would you call this, a level from which you cannot fall farther in economic terms, but there's a lot of ways in which you could keep falling and no one can stop that. Psychologically, in addiction to drugs, in terms of health, yeah, sure, you might be guaranteed to get food if you want it, no matter how much you fuck up your business. But in terms of psychology and your general physical health, I don't think there's any layer of security that the government can give you or society in general can act as in a collective insurance towards those two things.
Yeah, I think it's difficult to try and establish exactly what the floor is. Obviously, the ceiling is infinite. You know, you can become the next billionaire, the next Elon Musk, the next Bill Gates. But it's really where that floor lies. And for most civilizations or most economies, let's say, you have benefits, you have social housing, you have healthcare that if you are under a certain wage bracket, you will get looked after. Even if, you know, you mentioned the heroin situation there, where, you know, you're a drug addict, there are still people to help you. You know, there are Alcoholics Anonymous and these drug centers that help you to rehabilitate. So there is always someone there to an extent to help you get back above that threshold. And the reason I mentioned that threshold earlier is that if you made mistakes in it prior to the world star that we're into today in terms of the economy, industrial revolution, all of that, prior to all of that, if you made a mistake, you were generally going to die.
Yeah. I've been lately thinking quite a bit about a complex idea I've been trying to grapple with, to which I haven't been able to determine a solution to, but I would love to hear your opinion about it. There's different layers of analysis that you could apply to the world. And if you're a consequentialist, which I think everyone is at a certain point, because you ultimately care about consequences, if not, why do anything? But if you are a narrow consequentialist, you might consider robbing people from their organs so that you can save two people. Let's say you are healthy, you have quite nice organs, I could rob them from you so that I could use those to save two lives, and that in a consequentialist and in a narrow consequentialist way of seeing it, it would be worth it. But if you broaden your perspective and you realize how insecure society would be and how fucked up people would become mentally due to the insecurity of not knowing when they are going to be robbed from their organs, and how the ripple effects of that measure would make them appear or want to appear to you as being less physically fit, all those consequences, second and third order consequences, have not been taken into consideration in the narrow consequentialist analysis. But if you take those into account, you realize that, hey, maybe robbing people from their organs is not actually the correct thing. And the exact same thing happens with marriage. You might consider someone else to be more worth it. Let's say you find a 7 and you're married to her. But I'm sure there will be a moment in your life in which you perceive that there's someone who's an 8. But the unconditional relationship that you are developing with someone is actually permitting you to raise to higher heights than you would have if you were constantly trying to be pragmatic in a narrow sense. And the same thing, again, happens, just so I can give some examples of this exact phenomenon occurring at different parts of our society. It occurs with courts. You would certainly be able to see a situation in which taking justice in your own hand would be optimal due to the efficacy and the speed at which you could deploy that justice if someone robs you. But on average, society would be much better off if people restrain themselves from doing that. They call the police and they make a jury be able to judge the situation in a rational way, accessing all the information in a cold-blooded manner. That's statistically better than alternative. In the same way, marriage is, and maybe not robbing people from their organs to save more people is also statistically positive. What do you think? Is there a relationship between building an unconditional relationship with something or someone and being able to access further long-term gains, which would not be accessible if you were trying to just seek for the short-term ones?
Yeah, so I think there's a lot there, isn't there, we can talk about. We can talk about the taking of organs, what that means from a relationship standpoint. So I'll try and, if I can, cover some points, and then we can maybe have a discussion beyond that. But I think if you were to steal people's organs, I think there's a moral and ethical discussion to have there, and even whether or not it's beneficial. Now, you might say, well, if someone's got a healthy kidney or whatever organ you want to utilise, and someone has an unhealthy kidney, is it beneficial to have to steal person A's kidney and replace it in person B? I would question whether or not it is even beneficial, because survival of the fittest should obviously be something that's discussed. If we think of the human race at the moment, again, coming back to what we talked about earlier, people would generally die out. If they had diseases, they would die. If they injured themselves, they would die. If they put themselves in a situation they had no resources, they would die. And what that would mean is that those people who made less mistakes are more likely to breed, and therefore their offspring are likely to become stronger. And as humans, we then build a more superior race. I think when you come to a point where you are always looking after the weakest soldier, you, not by design, but through sort of genetics, essentially, you are lowering the gene pool and allowing for diseases to continue, I think, to an extent.
Let me push back on that. I don't think that's true at a wider if you accept a wider perspective. In the narrow perspective of just seeing how much certain viruses spread, sure, you're right, and in the short term. But that characteristic of taking care of the weak has not been selected for randomly. It has been selected for in exposure to a lot of environment in millions of years. So that intuition that we have, that taking care of the weakest is the correct thing to do, is not so naive as you might conceive in the first place. That's something similar to what happens with sexual reproduction. Why is it that we cannot clone ourselves? If I'm fit, I'm working fine, why not just clone myself? Okay, so it's been shown that statistically, it's much better to mix your genes with someone else so that on average in the long term, all the negative factors get diluted and also the positive ones. So you might not get an evolution as fast as it could get in a entity that reproduces itself, but it has been selected for precisely because of the benefits and the capacity to eliminate bad mutations.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, when you're having kids with someone, you displace the negative genes to an extent, and that's what the female does is from her side. But that doesn't really reflect the issue of breeding to an extent, because yes, that's generally two people who see themselves and see each other as people who are a good fit for breeding, essentially. But what we're saying, or the initial question was, should I steal a healthy organ from someone to put into someone who's ill? I think that's a slightly different conversation than actually cloning versus reproducing to dilute or get rid of some of the inherent bad genes within the individual. So I think that's a slightly different conversation. But coming back to what you said at the start with regards to stealing organs and then relationships as well. But one thing I want to sort of put in the middle there is that it's a case of capitalism versus resource-based economy as well, isn't it? Because capitalism is obviously incentivizing people to create something for profit so that something is, number one, created and that they are benefited from doing that, both themselves and employees and those who are consuming the products and service. The other alternative is what's called a resource-based economy, which is similar to the organ question, where you're saying, well, should Mr. Smith have his organ stolen from Mr. Jones because it's the resources there and we're going to use that to spread across the economy? The question is, well, would that be a suitable alternative? So as an example, if you had gold, and actually let's not use any real things. Let's say that you found this new Leukosade X. It's a new, I've got a Leukosade there, that's why I thought of Leukosade. Leukosade X is a new a new stone, let's say. And that stone can do two things. One is it can look really pretty, or two, it can cure all illness. And Mr. Jones wants to buy that stone to sit on his mantelpiece for $1 billion. But Mr. Jones wants to buy it for £500 and it's going to save all of his family's life. Under a resource-based economy, there wouldn't be that issue of price, because it would be, well, where's that resource going to be best used? Is it going to be best used on the fireplace of Mr. Smith, or best used to save Mr. Jones's life? And I think that the question that you've basically asked is a sort of reflection of that in some respects, of is it morally and ethically correct that capitalism exists, or morally and ethically correct that maybe a resource-based economy would exist in terms of where resources would be best placed? But the sub-question to that would be, well, who decides what's morally and ethically correct? That's what I would ask.
I don't think that dichotomy that you were trying to posit there in the distinction between a capitalist society and a resource-based economy exists, actually, because capitalism is the allocation of resources in a decentralized manner, in a way that makes people internalize costs and benefits. That is the best way to handle the resources of an economy, in my opinion. If you assume all the costs and the benefits, and there's a way of not using your resources to maximize your most egoistical and useless objectives, like it would be in the case, in the first case that you mentioned, that person will be in a capitalistic society depleted from resources in the long term if he keeps doing those stupid transactions, because someone with a bigger amount of money will be able to purchase that for more than he was willing to do so, and then save a lot of people's lives, and then use those extra times, that extra time that has been liberated from those people, because they are not going to die in 5 minutes, to be invested in a worthy manner. So that person doing that foolish investment is depleting its own resources. And in a capitalistic society, the solution will be found much faster than one in which there's a central government, a centralized politburo, which tries to govern over what or where is invested.
I agree. I think capitalism is the correct mode. And that the discussion of the resource-based economy was to compare that with the stealing of an organ, because it's a fair comparison in some regards of as to a moral and ethical discussion on what would be best in that regard. But it's a more complicated discussion than even that, I think, because then you could say, well, if someone's got 17 cars and someone has none, is it fair to pass those on? But as we've just discussed, it's not, because then you are providing benefit to someone who doesn't deserve it, and then they then continue to behave in such a way that they are benefited from poor decisions, which I don't think is good either. So I think it's a very complicated area, and I don't think there's a right or wrong answer. And that's why you mentioned courts before. That's why everything is dealt with on an individual basis. You can't make generalized rules sometimes. It's based on individual situations. And as you said, you look at the positives and negatives, you look at the resources used, you look at the net benefit, the net cost, and then you make decisions based on that. And that's what you have to do in every instance, not just generalize it across the board. Yes, you can make some generalizations, but even within that, there has to be specificity as to what you're trying to achieve.
Yeah. The unconditional commitment that you can develop in a interaction with someone allows for deeper consequences to emerge from it than if you were just there for the short term. It applies to with the three examples I mentioned. We're not here just for the short-term benefit I could derive from your organs. Your organs are there in an unconditional manner in your body until you decide to do otherwise. But I don't think there's a lot of libertarian philosophers and economists who argued about the inherent value of human life, or the, I don't know if the inherent value of human life would be the best way to frame it, but it would be basically saying that there are some things which are in itself bad and cannot be changed. The moral status of those actings cannot be changed independent of the context. I do not think that's true. If you prove to me that with a certain level of guarantee that stealing people's organs is net positive in the long term, and it will lead to more flourishing in the long term, and it will reduce the existential risks that we are assuming as a species, I would totally grant you that that's a great measure to be taken. I don't think there's any preconceived notions which are unconditionally committed to that we should embrace.
But surely, you know, it shouldn't even be a conversation that the stealing of organs is going to be okay, because at least if we're going to have any freedom, at least obviously with freedoms being diminished on a day-by-day basis, the freedom of our own body should surely be something that we can at least hold as close as possible to ourselves, essentially, without someone or the threat of it being stolen, essentially.
Oh, yeah, sure. The second-order consequences are horrible, and it would make it net negative. But in the hypothetical stance in which that was proven to be net positive in the third, fourth, fifth order consequences, I would position myself for the stealing of people's organs. My supporting of capitalism is entirely dependent of the information I have been granted until now. I've been trying to do an analysis of what measures tend to be more positive, and until now, with the evidence I've been able to gather, I've concluded that capitalism is the best thing. So I only see one thing as being deserving unconditional commitment to, and that is dialogue. I have in the description of my podcast, the purpose of dialogue is to let ideas die instead of us. That is ultimately the scientific method. And that, I think, should be committed to in an unconditional manner, which should not be granted to anything else. That's the thing that we should put dogmatically at the highest level of our hierarchy, and nothing else should supersede that.
I agree. I think that, as you rightly said there, in terms of it's better to have a conversation about something and let the idea die than people or countries or economies, etc. So absolutely, and that's where it's good to have intelligent people discuss an idea to see what the, as you said, net benefit, the cost, and the possible offshoots that could happen in terms of subsequent happenings, should we say, in some respects. Because if X creates Y, then obviously Y must have options of A, B, and C. And then if you went down A and said, well, that's going to have A squared, B squared, C squared in terms of potential options, we need to explore as many options as we can. And when you get past a certain level of investigation, let's say, you will discount that idea completely because you will see that the net position at the end is of no real benefit considering all of the resources put forward.
So you are not unconditionally devoted to the idea of respecting other people's organs. You're conditionally devoted to it in the sense that until people prove you with a certain level of certainty, which should have a huge standard of rigorosity to the analysis that you should ask for, because this is an incredibly relevant circumstance which should not be played with lightly. What I was saying is that you do not advocate for that in an unconditional manner. You don't have that at the top of the hierarchy. There's something which is even higher, and that is subjecting in a decentralized manner to your ideas to a process of natural selection.
Yeah, well, let's take that as an example. Natural selection and the breeding of individuals. So, because I feel that for some things, moral and ethics supersedes all. So as an example, a rational discussion could say, well, what we should do is we should not allow people with certain genetic dispositions or illnesses or people under a certain height or people with certain IQ, et cetera, should not be allowed to breed. And we should, as a society, select who breeds with each other to ensure the best possible outcome for us as human race. Now, in terms of maths and logic, you could make an argument for that being, if you played that out over 200, 300, 400 years, that being of a net benefit. However, above that net benefit is going to be the moral and ethical decision that will supersede all of that logic, all of that argument, all of that maths, all of the biology within that. So I think that all of those types of discussions are superseded by moral and ethical standpoints. Now, obviously, you could go into like eugenics and World War One, etc., and that's why it's so frowned upon, because the moral and ethical standpoint that that us society take on things like what Adolf Hitler did, etc., if that makes sense.
Yeah. During a conversation with my friend Luca, I had an incredibly deep insight about this, which is, if I do not take into account your irrationality, I am irrational. This relates to the fact that, okay, maybe eugenesis seems plausible and beneficial for society. Why not get rid of all the weak people in our society? Okay, yeah, that seems plausible as a extremely narrow way of analyzing things. But then you realize that, hey, maybe people do not agree with this idea, and they are going to believe that this is scandalous, and I do too. So the amount of fury that you are going to be generating in society is going to be so massive that it's net negative. So you have to take into account the, quote, irrationality of society in order to be able to act rationally. And I'm not advocating for eugenics. I'm just saying that if you are being stolen by someone, the rational thing to do is not to try to argue with them, hey, actually, stealing is not something civilized and you shouldn't be doing this. No, you have to have another plan. You're either going to act violently in a way that guarantees your safety, so you can nullify their acting, or you're going to cede your belongings and just give them to the thug. That's the only way of acting. And this can happen with anything. Fascism, okay, it might have a great and solid foundation, which might make people that it is a great idea, which is one of the most delirious ideas I've ever heard. But the people who were trying to enact fascism or any authoritarian movement in history were not seeing how there was going to be a pushback of towards those ideas that would inhabilitate their ideas, no matter how successful they or actually good they are. You can represent reality at different levels of analysis. You might be saying that I am ugly, and that might be true, but if I'm not going to be taking it right, the way we're going to be interacting makes that statement false at another level. At the level of maximizing flourishing, it's false. And I would say with fascism and eugenics, those are in the root false or in it in themselves, but people who truly believed in them believed them to be true, and while doing so were not even able to realize how much pushback they would get, so that them, by believing that other people were irrational, were actually believing that they were the rational people without taking into account other people's irrationality according to their standard, and that is irrational.
But it's all subjective, isn't it? You know, you mentioned looks and things like that. It's subjective. Who decides what would be considered as good and bad? Would it be a consensus? Would it be proved mathematically? Would it be proved through science? And again, even science could not be proved beyond its hypothesis. So there's too many questions there as to what would be the optimum solution. But what we know, as I said, is that the moral and ethical situation would supersede any discussions in that regard. You mentioned violence as well, and I think that that's absolutely true, because with any idea, if it is believed strongly enough and it has enough of a following and it still isn't implemented, violence is always resorted to. Disagreements, protection, you mentioned obviously fascism, but not just fascism, but in terms of any political event throughout history, whether it's wars, etc., violence always is the final piece of a puzzle. If ideas cannot be put forward pragmatically and through coercion or through persuasion or through any of those means, violence will subsequently ensue.
Yeah. That's why a respect to dialogue should be the highest thing we have. Because if you eliminate the possibility of having a dialogue, let's say I'm stronger than you, so I could beat you in the short term, and I could force you into doing something that you do not want to. Probably not, because you are a master in judo, but never mind. Let's keep with this hypothetical stance. Maybe I could derive a short-term benefit out of the forcing you to do something against your will, but I'm inhabilitating future discussion by advocating for violence as a means of achieving status. And this has been shown in the work from the primatologist Franz De Waal, in which he proved that primates, and this happens in a lot of species, but in some specific ones more than in others, it's not the alpha male is not the one who's the most violent. It's the one who's able to integrate the most the collective. And he's a peacemaker, basically. He's the most peacemaking of all the group. And that's because if you are the alpha male, you might be able to have access to mates or food in the short term, but that's at the expense of building alliances in the second and third ranking males, which would outpower you in a 1-3 fighting. You cannot outfight a collective of three. And that forces the system in a Nash equilibrium way, as we talked in the last day, to a state in which violence is not the thing selected for, because it is not stable, but actually cohesion is.
Yeah, it was something that you talked about earlier, wasn't it? Short-term versus long-term benefit. And I think that short-term, the exploitation of someone, either physically, verbally, emotionally, or a combination of all three, can give some short-term benefit. But if you're looking at long-term benefit, you need to command respect, not demand respect, command respect from people. And the way that you give that is by being empathetic, by giving things out, by, as you said, creating a network of people and being responsible for them. Because even if we look at the past, you know, kingdoms were run by kings, empires were run by emperors, and now countries are run by cunts. And that's the situation we're in now, whereby many of the governments are like dystopian nightmares, essentially, where they are saying, do as I say, not as I do, essentially. Whereas in the past, the person who was leading the civilization was someone who was on the front line, someone who could command an army. And that's a completely different hierarchical structure than it is today, where it's basically unelected officials who are there to deliver a message, sell out their soul, essentially, to ensure that the masses are kept under control. So there's a complete dichotomy there of where we are today as to where we were, I don't know, hundreds and hundreds of years ago, prior to the economic situation that we're in today. You mentioned primates as well. Most gorillas, as an example, the two alpha males will prefer not to fight because they know it's mutually assured destruction. Same thing. You know, if you don't have to use violence, there are other ways to do that. As you said, is it a 3-on-1 situation? Is it the fact that you actually are injured and you don't want to fight for whatever reason, and you're using other means to try and avert from that? So I think there is a lot more than violence. I'm not an advocate saying that, you know, violence should always ensue, but what I am saying is that if all other avenues fail, violence is generally the last resort. And, you know, you've seen that essentially throughout history, as it were. So, but one thing that Jordan Peterson said that sort of backs up what you said, essentially, is that the alpha male isn't always the one who is the most violent, but maybe they are likely to win against those who are more violent. So Jordan Peterson says that you should be someone who is basically a dangerous man, but who is not acting dangerously currently. So you've got the ability to be dangerous, but you aren't acting dangerously. So, you know, even if you go to the gym, if you were to go to a fight gym, as an example, generally the best person there is not always the most aggressive, if that makes sense.
But it is the one who is the most capable of deploying violence if the situation requires so.
Exactly. Yeah. So they can beat all of. So if you think of Top Trumps, you know the game Top Trumps.
No, I do not.
Where you've got cards in it. So it's basically a game, like a card game, where it gives each character attributes and numbers and 1 to 100. So for example, Alex, it will say intelligence 95, height 60, or whatever it's going to be. Yeah. So, Top Trumps is essentially that sort of thing. So what it would say is obviously. For the males that we're discussing, it might say, well, males 2, 3, and 4 out of the top 10 have got 95 aggression, but fighting ability might only be 92. Whereas the best fighter would maybe be 100 in terms of ability, but maybe down at 85 in terms of outright or consistent aggression. The aggression would come when is required, but it wouldn't be someone who's outright aggressive. It's a bit like small man syndrome. Or small dog syndrome, where they are the yappiest little dogs all the time. But when it came to it, the big dog would assert their dominance. And I think it's a little bit like that. Not that I'm comparing humans to dogs necessarily, but there is always a crossover between species in terms of behavior. Hence why in psychology, they use rats for studies, they use dogs, etc., because there is a cross-correlatory relationship between the two.
If you want peace, you have to be prepared for war, don't you? If you want peace.
Yeah, if you want peace. Yeah, exactly. And the thing with violence, and this is quite interesting for me, it's not necessarily hating what's in front of you. It's loving what's behind you. So either if it's just one-on-one, you love yourself, which comes out as hatred towards the other person. If you are defending your country against communism, fascism, socialism, whatever it's going to be, you obviously hate that ideology, but you love the country you're in, or you love the people that you're with, that then comes out to outright aggression. So, you know, the law of yin and yang, or equal and opposites, or the law of gender, whichever of those you want to use, love has to be equal to hate in that example.
You mentioned before...
It's the same thing.
Yeah. You mentioned before the tragedy of the commons that comes from separating people from the consequences of their acts, like in a Roman emperor who's the first in the line of battle. Nassim Taleb has a great quote from his book Skin in the Game, which is, "Bureaucracy is a construction by which a person is conveniently separated from the consequences of his or her actions." This perfectly catches what you were trying to imply and eloquently described. If you are separated from the consequences of your actions, you are basically going to assume a much bigger amount of costs than you would if you were assuming all the costs.
Well, this is it. I think that especially nowadays with where things are, people don't always see the consequences till a lot later in life. You know, even the OnlyFans models, as an example, they might see short-term monetary in input, but what they won't see is the long-term degeneration of their ability to have family and kids, because who's going to want to go out with someone like that? It also has a degeneration on society, whereby more men become simps, as an example, rather than strong males. Like we talked last time off air, didn't we, about the fact that most kids now have seen more naked women, I know it's on the screen, than the emperors of history. So again, it's a consequence. We talked about the fair about this last time as well, porn, whereby people are masturbating without having or without understanding or creating that experience for themselves. They are basically getting the benefit without having to put in the necessary work in.
Those two were designed to be hand in hand. If you separate them, you derive a situation which is negative.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, we have to be able to value our actions and understand what the costs and benefits are. Now, if we actually bring this back a step, and we talked about emperors and being on the battlefield, etc., the way that the current elite have got it is whereby they're not even on the chessboard anymore. They're not a bishop. They're not a knight. They aren't a rook. They aren't the queen. They're not even on the chessboard. So you can't attack them if you wanted to, because they are inaccessible. What they have got on the chessboard instead is your Boris Johnsons, your Liz Trusts, your Joe Bidens, etc., who are on the chessboard. They are the chess piece. But they have, what are those, you know, the puppets? Masonette, is it Masonettes? Or something like that, where they control them like this? But essentially they're puppets, aren't they, for the global elite? So, again, with that, the global elites, their consequences and benefits are escalated in respect of the benefits they see, the consequences they don't see.
And a winner takes all situation emerges from which we weren't used to dealing with that. If in a village there's no many extreme situations in which the winner takes all, but now on YouTube and with podcasts, the few who are the greatest gets the 99.9% of the views, and then the rest of the people are left with almost no views. And that could only happen when the marginal cost of replication is reduced to zero.
Yeah, but like with anything, the best always get the most, and everyone else is left with every, you know, the remnant. Should we say? I don't know the stats, but it's something ridiculous. Like the top 1% have got more wealth than pretty much everyone else combined. I don't know exactly what it is. I don't know if it's over 50% or everyone, but it just shows that for those people at the top in any scenario are always going to get most of the benefit. And what we're essentially saying is that the consequence of that for those global elites is not seen, because if it was before, where they were the leader of a tribe or they were managing a village, if people didn't like how they were managing things, as you said, the three gorillas could come and attack the one gorilla. And although he's the best, three on one is no contest. So that is now out of the equation because these people are inaccessible. So their consequences for their actions do not have as much effect as they should do. But obviously the benefits do because they see the money rolling in and they can control fiscal monetary policy, how they see fit. They can implement wars, military wars. They can discuss a narrative or put forward a narrative and everyone listens to it. So it's a very close to checkmate situation in that regard. But I'm optimistic because even, you know, Roman Empire, I think, was it 1500 years, Roman Empire, roughly? It was something ridiculous. And that came to an end. Things do change, but we are in a bit of a technocracy at this point. And that means that it's a lot more difficult to have any uprising. I'm not saying that we should or it's going to happen, but in terms of we're talking about cost benefit analysis here and looking at if you were to go down option A, what would happen, etc. If that was to happen, it would be a much more difficult situation than it would have been in the past through surveillance.
Depending how you define it, a technocracy is unavoidable because a technocracy, by definition, is the ruling of the people who can or who are the most competent. And if you are the most competent at surviving or reproducing, you are going to out-reproduce other people. And that's ultimately everything in the universe is subject to a process of natural selection, you want it or not. So ultimately, there's a technocracy in everything. Be it in societies, be it in materials, be it in planets, in gravitational constants, whatever you analyze, it's all subject to a process of natural selection.
Yeah, but in terms of like using technology to control people, like if we look at China, for example, the social credit scoring, and again, we talked earlier about moral versus non-moral. You know, is it moral to stop someone traveling out the country based on certain behaviours? Some may argue saying, well, yes, you shouldn't be dropping cigarettes on the floor. You shouldn't be stealing someone's organs, you know, -1,000 points. You shouldn't be doing X, Y, and Z. But then the argument would be again, well, who decides what is right and wrong in those situations? Why should that person behind the desk have control over this person? So I think it's a very difficult conversation to have in that regard because I don't think there's any categoric evidence. If you, like, remember at school where you used to have an experiment and used to say aim, objectives, method, prediction, conclusion, etc. In this example, I don't think there would necessarily be a conclusion.
I think there is. Who has decided whether you question who has the power to choose what is then?
Who has the power to choose? Yeah, but we don't have the power to choose as we believe. So.
No. That wasn't my point. I was claiming who has chosen whether you posit the question of who has the power to choose. You were saying just a minute ago, who chooses what the correct moral standard is? And you stating that question, someone or something has to have chosen that act in order for it to merge in your brain. And I do not think there's any choosing in that process. It's just natural selection. It's just the emergence out of chaos, which the piece of the system which is the most reliable and most capable of reproducing itself, like in the neural firings that just have gone in your brain and which have made that idea come out of your mouth. The thing that has made you be able to say that is a fight between different ideas in your brain, which have made that idea emerge out of all the chaos in your brain. The same thing applies to the CCP in China. Why is the China's Communist Party ruling in China? Because there's no other party which has outcompeted them in a Darwinian sense.
Well, exactly, but it doesn't necessarily mean to say that what they're doing is right in that regard, because just because things are in control, it doesn't mean that everyone's happy about it. If we look at just making a comparison. So CCP, if you were to ask everyone who was a China resident whether they agreed with all of the rules, majority would say no. So that, for me, says it's a failed society. Because the role of a leader, yes, it is to instill discipline and ensure the best for the country long term, but it's also to ensure that everyone is content within that country. Because we said who was to decide whether it's right or wrong. It's usually society who decides what is right and wrong. Because if we all agree that this is the right way to go, but then the government says, no, it's not, that is a dichotomy. Because if we all agree that democracy should be different than it is today, but then those who are already in power say, no, it shouldn't, who's right? I would argue that society is correct and that the government isn't in that regard.
Well, if society articulates an offense against the ruling power, the ruling power would stop being the ruling power. There has to be an implicit consent in society or an inability to articulate an offense, an effective one.
Not anymore. It wouldn't. Before, that's what I'm saying, before, if the leaders were unliked by those who they served, they would be overthrown. It's not as simple as that anymore.
Mm. You're a coach, Yvan. Don't you think that ultimately coaching is making people understand that there's a distinction between what feels good and what is good?
Yes and no, because at the end of the day, everything you do is to feel good over the long term. So yes, it's not about feeling good today, but you're doing something today to at some point feel content. You know, you want to have, you know, it's not going to be nice now to have kids and get up at five, like have 2 hours sleep for the next 3 years and work two jobs and go to the gym and it feels horrible. But you are doing that on the hope of a future happiness where you've got a lovely family, you've got money in the bank, you can go and travel abroad. So yes, I don't subscribe to the argument that you always need to be happy, but you are doing it based on an aim into future happiness. And it's how to best go about doing that. Okay, well, I want to start a business and I want to do X, Y, and Z. But what's holding you back then from doing that? It might not work, people might judge me. If that's what's holding you back, sometimes you need to understand why you feel like that and to maybe readjust the sail to say, okay, well, like, for example, why would you take on the opinion of someone or care about what they think about you when you wouldn't even ask them for advice? So if you've got a friend who you wouldn't even ask for advice, why do you care about what they think of you?
A bias. We are biased towards considering information around us as relevant.
Exactly, exactly. But what I'm saying is that if you're going to make an important decision, and that's holding you back, or as you said earlier, imposter syndrome is holding you back, I don't feel that I am qualified to talk about this. So, for example, us two today, the conversation isn't really part of our remit to an extent. I know you're the podcast host and, you know, we can go on to any discussion. But if I felt that I had imposter syndrome, or you felt that you had imposter syndrome, where you thought, oh, I'm not really qualified to talk about these subjects, you know, they're a bit sort of off the cuff, they're a little bit immoral, or not immoral, but discussing moral, ethical standpoints, you wouldn't discuss that, which means that you wouldn't have a fantastic podcast and you wouldn't have these discussions, essentially. Same thing. You know, if you're someone who has that feeling, oh, well, actually, I'm not even that good at cutting hair, I shouldn't really start on my own, or you've got a fear of failure. Oh, do you know what? If I fail, I'm going to feel really bad about myself. And actually, even if I do make it, I've got a fear of success, because what if I lose all my good friends because they aren't moved up to the level that I'm at? What if I can't handle the success because I'm going to spend it all on cocaine and hookers? So these are the sorts of things that people need discussing, and even the direction that they want to take. They might think that, until they ask themselves a question. So at the start of the show, you said, I've been contemplating whether this will be morally correct or not. You had to think of that first before it became a discussion. The same thing, you know, us as coaches, we have to ask the question for you to come up with an answer, if that makes sense. So, okay, why did you get sacked from your last job? Or why did your relationship break down? Okay, then they give the answer. Then we come up or listen to what they're saying. As you said, more information, we can then have an opinion and we can ask subsequent questions that we then get to the root cause. And they say, oh yeah, I got sacked because I was coming in late to work and I didn't even like my job. Okay, so what alternatives are there? So it's, as you said earlier, you know, you've got different outcomes or different possible actions you can take. And what does that look like in 2 or 3, four steps types, like contingency plans, like Prison Break as an example. And that's what we talk through with clients essentially. So
Maybe in the same way that I was arguing about broadening our perspective about certain subjects, and that would make us consider the alternative moral stance as correct, like in stealing people's organs. The same thing could happen with what I just said about coaching, is understanding that there's a differentiation between what feels good and what is good. Maybe it's not about rejecting what feels good ultimately, but broadening the perspective so that you understand that if your time frame is not one day, but let's say a lifetime, you have to be investing into a marriage and a career and your health. And you should ditch all the cocaine and the prostitutes and the porn in your life in order to do so.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so let's take it this way. This is an example I really like to talk about. I've had clients whereby they've got a five-year plan. They want to become a millionaire. They want to have the six-pack. They want to have a beautiful wife who's 10 out of 10, who's intelligent, who's a family woman, who has got a low body count. They want to have a network of friends. They want to have their own podcast. They want to have everything. Well, it's not a problem, because I've got goals similar to that to an extent. I mean, everyone does, don't they? They have an ambition. But there's two guys. There's two different versions of this Mr. Jones. The current version is someone who drinks 5 pints a day. They don't exercise. They entertain themselves more than they educate themselves. They consume more than they produce. They sleep in late. They've got a low-paying job. They don't upskill themselves. The other person, Mr. Smith, I mean, I like Mr. Smith and Mr. Jones, just easy. Mr. Smith has the same goals, but he goes to the gym every day. He dates girls. He started his business because he psychologically got into the right place where he didn't have imposter syndrome, wasn't scared of failure, etc. He reads every day, even if it's something online or an audiobook. He networks. He understands that personal development is the most important thing. He self-reflects. He writes in journals. He goes through his own thought process. He is someone who takes care of his finances. He has a side hustle as well. He travels. At the end of 5 years, those people are going to be so far apart that it's going to be almost impossible for Mr. Jones to catch up to Mr. Smith, even though they had the same goals. So goals is just a start. Once you've got the goals, you need to break that down into daily habits and daily routines. Okay, well, I want to have a six-pack in 12 months' time. Okay. The main two parts of that are diet and exercise, aren't they? There's not much else. So, okay, what does my diet need to look like for the next 12 months? And what does my exercise regime need to look like for the next 12 months? Okay. You can pretty much work that out to yourself, unless you're someone who's not really that intelligent or not that computer savvy. You can go online and check what foods will help me to reduce body fat, what exercises are good for six packs. It's just a question, like I said, I say all the time, it's all about the questions you ask to get the answers. If you're not answering that question, I would ask, why aren't you asking the question of a result you want? Anyway, after 12 months, he's been doing those things every day. He's been doing his sit up, his crunches, his what other exercises he's researched. And he's also been eating the relevant diet. At 12 months, he's 100% more likely, I'm not saying going to have one, 100% more likely to have a six-pack than Mr. I can't remember which way around it was, Mr. Jones, I think it was, that doesn't do that. He just eats the same shit. He's always he eats crisps every day. And he's wondering at the end of 12 months, why haven't I got a six-pack? It's because you're not undertaking the relevant goals. I mean, I'll use myself as an example. I'm writing another book at the moment, and it's slightly behind schedule, but it's still fairly on schedule. And all I did was to say, I'm going to write a page a day, pretty much. And at the end of 365 days, that's pretty much there, isn't it? Rather than me having an overwhelming task, oh, I need to write a book, I don't know where to start. Do I need to do 12 hours and just get deep into that, or do I break it down and make it nice and easy for myself in some respects? And I think that sometimes we don't, as individuals, break down things into manageable tasks.
Yeah, there's a great example that Nassim Taleb gives in his book Antifragile about how if you like having written a book, but you do not like the process of writing it, please stop doing that and free the world from such a shitty thing that you're going to do if you're not enjoying the process. Maybe the same thing could be applied to people who do not enjoy doing the hard work in the short term, because I've realized that I actually enjoy working out, reading books. All these things are enjoyable in the short term, and I derive from it a long-term and a short-term value. There's an alignment between my long-term and short-term objectives that has only come from the realization that there's a distinction between what feels good and what is good. And so I have applied a process of maybe natural selection in accordance to what maximizes my long-term well-being, in that I have curated my habits and I'm extremely satisfied with my habits right now.
But you will be, because as you said, if you enjoy the process and you understand that you are chasing a carrot, it keeps you motivated. Now, for some people, they need a stick. They need to be hit with a stick to be beaten into shape. And for others, it's a carrot. I'm a carrot person. Some people aren't. Some people are, you know, they need the stick, essentially. But as you said there, and this is where, as we talked about right at the start of the show, if you've got an ability in something and you're passionate about it, you'll always beat someone with either just passion or just ability. So we need to enjoy what we're doing to get the best out of ourselves. Like, you will never become a world champion tennis player unless you enjoy playing tennis, because you've got to play 6 hours a day. Like, same with your career. If you don't enjoy your career and you're like, oh, I've got to send this email, I've got this meeting, oh, you're never going to get to the top. And if you look at like what Earl Nightingale, I think, what was his, he's got a few books, can't remember what it was called at this point. Leader of the field, that was it. Leader of the field, lead the field. You know, if you want to be this top 1%, you've got to be the leader of the field in some respect. Like you said earlier, podcast, the top few podcasters get most of the views because they are leaders in the field. And we need to aspire to try and get there. And look, not everyone can get there. Everyone says, oh, I want to be top 1%. I want to be top 1%. I want to be top 1%. Even I say that. What's the chance of me getting there? Well, not much, is it, based on stats and based on math. But we have to maybe try throw shit at the wall, see what sticks. Because you might not have been blessed with Usain Bolt's sprinting ability or tennis ability of Roger Federer or Messi's football ability, which is such a niche, not a niche skill, but something that's so, it was so obvious they were good at it that they can spend all their time on that item without worrying about anything else, or to the detriment of everything else, essentially. Most people don't have a clear and obvious path like that. They have maybe something more niche. They have something that's skill stacked, where, like, I don't know if you know what skill stacking is, I'm sure you do, where you aren't just really good at one thing, but you have like a very unique set of skills where you might be charismatic and you might know a lot about IQ, for example, and you might be good in terms of computers. So you might be like, well, those three, I could do a good podcast here, if that makes sense. And you might have skill sets in other areas. Oh, I really like teaching people and I'm pretty good at football and I like spending time with kids. Okay, well, you might be able to skill stack that into a sports coach, if that makes sense. So I think that's for most people the new era of success is skill stacking. Because not everyone can be top 1% in any one activity. And because the world is changing so rapidly as well, you know, a lot of people try to tell them they got a degree, things have changed or whatever. Skill stacking is going to be the way forward. And like, for example, it's time as well. Like you talked about reading books. I do read and I like reading stuff online because I can flick through it and stuff. But if I'm trying to consume information, and we can talk about producing versus consuming in a moment, but I will use audiobooks a lot of the time, because while I'm walking the dog or while I'm washing the dishes or doing something more mundane, I can at least pick up a few gems, because I can't actually sit down and physically read a book, if that makes sense. I mean, I do read, as I said, but what I've got to look at, again, ask yourself a question. What is the best way that I can consume the material in the book while still doing other things? And I'm like, okay, well, audiobooks. Do I use the full audiobook, or do I use a summary? Because a lot of the time, summaries can give me the key points that I can then think about and go into more detail, because some books aren't worth reading the full book and some are. And then I say, okay, well, that looks like a great book. I've read the summary, that's cool. Maybe I'll read that in full or go down the audiobook in full. So I think I don't think there's right way and a wrong way for people to conduct their lives to an extent, but you need to ask yourself the right questions and you'll get answers that will fall in line with what your long-term objective should be in most cases, anyway.
The intersection between skills is much less populated than the skills in themselves. And it's also true that it's much greener of a field because there's much more left to exploit in the intersections.
Yeah.
And you are going to be not only competing with less people, but there's many more intersections than skills.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So like, if you're someone who speaks Spanish and French and you have got a degree in, I don't know, biology, you know, you're opening, how many people are there that can teach biology and that speak Spanish and French and English? There's probably not that many. So is that your niche area? You could say, well, actually, I need 100 grand a year because I can teach X, Y, and Z. But the thing you just said a second ago, a Jim Rohn quote that sums this up brilliantly is he said that you should work harder on yourself than you do on your job. I'll say that again. You should work harder on yourself than you do on your job. So for a lot of people, it's 9 to 5 and they don't work on themselves in any way, shape or form. No gym, no skills, no side hustle, no reading, nothing. And yes, there are some people who should just work on their job to an extent because they haven't got the ambition to do anything that much. All they want to do is sort of climb the corporate ladder. And the best way to do that is to be the hardest working and love the business and all that sort of stuff, even though I disagree with that to an extent. But that is obviously in the consensus for a lot of people, because I think that whatever you can do for the people, you can do for yourself to an extent as well. And you'll be remunerated more for it, but obviously the consequences, as we talked about earlier, consequences versus benefits are more, because if you start your own business, there are things that could happen. But for everyone else, well, even those people, what are you working on yourself at all? And if you're saying, well, okay, what am I doing Mondays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, total up how much time you're doing something productive. And even for me, productive is even things like even walking your dog, because that's something that's not, you know, you're not pissing around. That's you're responsible for that animal. So it's something that, you know, is still an activity that is considered valuable, should we say. How much, that's a better way to put it, valuable time. What are you doing that's valuable in all this time? Are you just watching Simpsons and then Family Guy, EastEnders, Emmerdale, all this crap? Or are you actually doing something valuable? Like, for me, obviously everyone wastes some time, but like for today, I've called some leads, I've been on calls, walked the dog, I've got judo later, I wrote some parts of my book, I write stuff on Cura as well. So yes, you know, I could be doing even more, and I've done other stuff as well, but I could be doing more, but at least they are items that are productive and are providing some value, rather than, as I said, I could be going to the casino and then, you know, going to see a lady of the night and then coming back and watching TV, you know, and that's not the best way to be.
Definitely. It's been lovely, Yvan. I know that you've got a webpage and Instagram. Where can people find more about you?
So I'm sure you'll leave all of the notes at the end, but Vanquish Transformational Coaching, I'm offering a free coaching session at the moment because of the new year. Book, Become a Person of Value, which is on Amazon. Instagram, Vanquish Transformational 2022. I'm writing a new book, which is a question a day. So it's going to be interactive. You can write down the answers yourself. So as we said, okay, where do I want to be in 3 to 5 years' time? I want to be a software developer in Vienna, earning £200,000 a year. Okay, well, how do we get there? And this is where you write down your answer. And then day two might be, okay, well, based on my personality type, what should I be doing? You know, am I introvert? Am I extrovert? As we talked about the skill stacking side of things. Okay, of all my friends, how do I rate each of them in terms of value? Because, look, you are the average of the 5 people you spend most time with, etc. Yeah, so if you're spending around time with bad people or low-quality people, you are more likely to be like that. And there's 3 types of friends as well. You've got friends that who are like utility friends who you can gain something from. You've got those who are enjoyment friends, yeah? And then you've got real friends. So that's split into two parts. There's deal friends, where there's a deal, and there's real friends. How many of them are deal friends and how many are real friends? You'll probably find that less than 10% are real friends. And if your life changed in any way, like I know a lot of people who are really friends with people because they both take drugs together or they both go out drinking. But other than that, there's no connection. There's no insight there between them as to anything mutual. So yeah, have a think about that. But yeah, that's the book's coming out, by the way. So yeah.
Yeah, your drinking makes me feel better about myself drinking.
Me drinking?
Yeah.
Yeah, I drink.
No. I wasn't claiming anything about you or me. I was just saying that if I'm with you and you are drinking, that justifies my drinking to a level which wouldn't allow me feeling bad as I would if I was drinking alone.
Yeah, exactly. So again, there's utility friends. So you both gain something. You know, are you giving someone a lift and they're giving you something for it or whatever? You know, utility friends. Or most of them are enjoyment friends where, you know, you both start going and having a drink or smoking or whatever you want to do. And as you said, that's to have some company while doing something. And then you've got real friends who are going to be there for you and whatever else. So, you know, if you had to actually sit and think, okay, write down on a piece of paper, which is going to be in the book. Okay, my 5-10 best friends, what do we do together? Okay, we drink, smoke. Gym, okay, so that's a utility friend. Do we have anything outside of that? Probably not. Gym, you know, we like cars together, which is good because it's a bit of an interest there, I suppose, etc. And how many are real friends? You'll be very, very surprised for a lot of you, I think.
What would be a real connection?
Like, you connect on many levels. Some people have got your back in any situation. Like, if you were to go broke, they would have you on their sofa, etc. There's not many people like that. That, as I said, you have connection on multiple levels, and it's not just one thing. Like, you could just chill. You know, it wouldn't have to be that you would be a utility base or, as I said, a pleasure base. There's something more there. You can talk about anything or whatever. So I think that, everyone inherently knows what a real friend is, don't they, anyway? I don't think you need to put a narrative on it. I think you inherently know people who are real friends and those aren't real friends.
I know that Becoming a Person of Value is available on Audible. Have you narrated it yourself?
No, so I don't think I've got the best narration voice, let's say. So I've got someone to do it who I think's a bit more user-friendly, let's say. That's what I opted for. Made a decision because I did sort of narrate a little bit myself and I thought, you know, people don't like the sound of their own voice anyway. And I just felt that, yeah, it was better with someone who's professional in that area, you know, because why be jack of all trades when there's someone who just narrates books? And, you know, well, I had not interviewed them, but I sampled a few of their work and I said, okay, yeah, I think you're going to be the best fit for the book. And obviously he narrated the whole thing. So,
okay. Yeah. I believe that in some cases, authors narrating their book gives it a feeling which no professional narrator could. But I understand your situation, and it's perfectly respectable.
I agree. I think authors are generally better when the author does their own book. But what I would say is that's generally for people who are a bit more of a public figure, I would say.
Okay.
Because like if Jordan Peterson's got a book or someone quite big in that regard, and you listen to it and it's someone else, you're like, oh. I was quite expecting Jordan to talk about existentialism and all this, the malevolence and all this sort of stuff, but he's not. But on the flip side, if you are not aware or familiar with the voice of this person, like Florence Scovel Shin, someone who I've listened to some audiobooks of her, there's some really good narrators on there. And I wouldn't know any different to an extent, but yeah, I think when the public figures, it's mandatory to an extent to actually narrate your own work. But that's about it on that piece. So
I will leave a link to all your mentions in the show notes. And
thank you.
And I hope people enjoy your book.
Thank you, Alex, for having me on. Been a pleasure as usual.
It's been a pleasure.